Dan Haar writes on business, the economy, politics, and the people of Connecticut for the Hartford Current, and occasionally he is a guest on our program. And he had a great column yesterday about Hartford and the possibility of the state's capital city filing for bankruptcy. And we welcome Dan to the program. Dan, how you doing?
Great, great, great. I'm not visible on the Facebook page live, am I?
No, you're not, but you can be heard.
Okay.
Although Facebook now has the technology, if you wanted to, I could have actually interviewed you that way as well.
Yeah, well, maybe it's better if we do it just with audio from me.
Anyway, this piece about Hartford, how bad is the situation?
Well, that's a great question, because the Hartford is in a situation where it's probably insolvent, meaning that the shortfalls that the city is starting to see year after year after year are not the result of surprises that come up. They simply, the city is not able to tax enough and get enough money from the state and elsewhere to make ends meet to a reasonable degree. And so that's a bad thing for a city to be in. But it is not Detroit. Detroit filed for bankruptcy in 2013 when the city was broken. They were police not able to get to emergency calls, fire. Literally, lights were being turned out. Street lights were being turned out because they didn't have enough money to make the city run from minute to minute. Hartford is not in that situation, and Mayor Luke Bronin has declared that he's not going to let Hartford get into that situation.
Well, how can Hartford not be in that situation when, as you write, as it is, the state underwrites about half of the city's annual budget? They're projecting a deficit for next year, and the unions have yet to give back, and that's how the current budget is predicated.
Well, I mean, so far, for example, the police department was replenished and fire. So you don't have, again, to use Detroit as a comparison, when they filed in 2013, in some ways, these two cities were opposite. Hartford has a problem that is too physically small. That is, Hartford is so small that most of the middle-class neighborhoods in the Hartford region, the vast majority, all but very few, one or two, are outside the city limits. So Hartford doesn't have what Stamford has, which is, for example, that area north of the Merritt, which is, you know, it resembles all the other towns down there. It's not a city. It's more of a sprawling town. Great tax base. Hartford doesn't have that. Detroit was so physically large that they couldn't take care of the physical area of the city. So it's a different problem, and Hartford isn't as bad off as Detroit was.
Now, you mentioned that, and also Hartford has the problem of what, almost 60% of its property is non-taxable, right?
Yeah, I mean, the number is a little, I've heard closer to 50 to 60. It depends how you measure it. And while that's a big problem for the city, some of that money is coming in from the state. And, you know, frankly, hospitals and state office buildings don't create need for school seats. They don't create a lot of crime. They don't create some of the problems. You still need to have city services consonant with the size of the city you have. But it's not like you've got, you know, state office buildings generating 2,000 kids for the schools. So that's a problem, but that's not really the only problem Hartford has. Really, the problem Hartford has is the lack of middle-class neighborhoods, because the size of the city is small enough that it only encompasses the core area of the region.
Yeah, what's the city, about 24 square miles?
18.
18? Whoa.
Yes, I think it's 17.9, but we say 18, and 18 is an awfully small core city, as you know.
So when the mayor talks about regionalism, and I see where the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities has put together an effort to cooperate as far as regionalism is concerned, and the mayor is on that board, but when he talks about regionalism, what does he mean?
Well, regionalism, in the mayor's view, means meaningful cooperation between cities and towns, such that they're able to share the burdens and the costs and the benefits of what they have to offer in a way that adds up. Right now we've got regionalism, you know, you've got a health department here and there, and you've got, shared health department. You've got, obviously, the water system is regional. I don't know how efficient it is, but it's regional. What we're talking about is more than just magnet schools, charter schools, and a few shared departments. It's a taxing district shared. And I don't think politically, and that's why I wrote the column that said we may be headed for bankruptcy in Hartford, because I don't think politically that that's in the cards.
Well, I mean, you read, for example, regionalism, and, you know, you talk about, you gave some examples, but one of the things I'm thinking about is the West Hartford taxpayer going to want to see some of its tax revenue go to help Hartford, I guess, is what people are concerned about.
Well, as a West Hartford taxpayer, I'm sitting in my West Hartford house right now. I'd have to say that the answer to that question is going to be no, despite the fact that West Hartford is an enlightened town that views itself rightly as part of a broader region which depends on the core city. Nonetheless, when it comes down to dollars and cents, I think that's going to be a tough sell. It's interesting that Governor Boughton from Danbury, excuse me, Mayor Boughton, I'm sorry. Did I say Governor Boughton?
You did, and he's glad you said it, too.
Oh, I'm sorry. He's starting his run, I guess, with this new CCM initiative, Connecticut Conference of Municipalities, which you referenced. So it is a bipartisan issue. And Mayor Boughton is a smart guy, and he's from a city, and he understands the need for that out there in western Connecticut as badly, not quite as badly, but, you know, significantly. And while I think the underlying needs are real, the political consensus is going to be impossible to get to.
Well, I know, for example, a lot of these towns, you said no, and a lot of these towns would probably say, look, Hartford already has half of the budget underwritten by the state of Connecticut. Why should even more of our tax dollars go to the capital city?
Well, that's right, and Hartford, unfortunately, has a habit of shooting itself in the foot like it did with the stadium. Even if the stadium had worked out perfectly, by the way, it still would have been $4.2 million a year in the high years of the 25-year lease that are coming out of Hartford, and most of the economic benefit is accruing to the region and the state in the form of jobs and sales taxes of added activity. So there was no way under the economic formula that the city was going to recoup that loss, that cost, I should say, unless there was a massive and rapid construction of Dono in the surrounding acres, which we, of course, are unfortunately not seeing.
Well, I want to get to the ballpark in light of what you wrote yesterday about the city's financial situation. Is this ballpark, particularly now that we've seen the internal audit, is this ballpark going to get completed?
Yeah, absolutely, because all sides have a bent. Listen, the ballpark is of no use right now. It's of no value right now. So you've got X amount sunk into it, let's say $50 million. You need to sink a little bit more into it to open it up and make it into a functioning asset to the region, and there's no reason why it won't happen. This is not like the casino, the would-be casino in the Hartford area, which is, you know, a political football, and should it be built and shouldn't it be built. The ballpark is sunk money. So maybe if Mayor Bronin had a choice to make right now from scratch, we would be in a different place. But there's no way he's going to not let that ballpark open on April 13th or 17th?
The 13th.
2017.
April 13th, yeah.
There will be baseball on April 13th, a year and a week late.
Well, but they've got to make that decision soon, or the Eastern League and Major League Baseball are going to say, we're out of here.
Listen, I get that, and it's unfortunate that I, Charles Matthews, the head of the Stadium Authority, made the statement back in June that it was going to be a 5 to 10 day investigation. I get that insurance companies have to take their time about making sure that they know, you know, all the I's and T's, but somebody's got to get in a room with Arch Insurance from Pennsylvania and say, spit it out, guys, make a decision, and let's go with it. And if there's a problem with the decision you make, there's money that's going to have to come somewhere else. Because you got about $5 or $10 million left to spend on the stadium, and you got a beautiful asset. Now, the asset doesn't create cash for the city, but it's still a great asset for the region.
Is it possible that it's going to cost more money to complete this ballpark than was originally thought, and Arch Insurance is going to say, well, we're not going to pony up that amount of money?
Yeah, I mean, that's possible. I don't think it's likely, having walked through it a number of times. You know, the Bears Smokehouse Pavilion is the significant area that's not yet built out. The field is in great shape. The boxes are in great shape. You got to move a few TVs. The punch list of items that's the source of so much acrimony on both sides is not a very expensive punch list. There are no big structural issues. This is just a matter of finishing touches and getting some carpentry work and getting this thing open with the doors and get it open. And it's going to happen by April 13th. Because it has to happen because it's so much to lose if it doesn't happen, and we're so close.
Oh, no question about it. But what I don't understand is originally, and we're talking round figures here, it was going to be $55 million to build this ballpark, and then the next thing you know, it's over $60 million, and so much was budgeted to meet that figure. And then the internal audit shows it's going to require $71 million to build this ballpark, Dan. So
yeah, most of the difference between the 62... The difference between the 52 or 3 or 5 and the 62 was plain vanilla cost overruns of the sort that you and I see when we do any work on our houses. If you've ever had anyone who's ever had a construction crew adding footprint, I'm not talking about, you know, painting, I'm talking about adding footprint to a house, 10% is what it costs above what you think it's going to cost. And that's just the way it is, and that's what happened here. But the rest of it is site work. And in September of 2014, I wrote a story that said site work is going to be $9, $10, $11 million, and you have to count that. And the city wasn't counting it. So this is not a new cost. It's a newly accounted cost in the audit report.
But can the city cover that cost, considering its financial situation?
It's done. It's already paid for and done. The cost that the auditor report said is not a new cost. In other words, they don't have to come up with the difference between $62 and $71 million. That's money that's been spent, but it's money that they were hiding, and I think that's a bit of a duplicitous piece of finance, if you ask me. And I'm not happy to see that they did it, and nobody else should be.
Hmm. Now, that said, as far as the lawsuits are concerned, will that hold this thing up some more?
Well, the lawsuits mostly have to do with who's going to get the work done. And of course, CenterPlan, you're referring to the lawsuit by CenterPlan against the city. You know, lawsuits like bankruptcy filings are, which are lawsuits, are invitations to negotiate a settlement. And whether there's a lawsuit or not, there needs to be a negotiated settlement. Somebody needs to get in and finish the job. I would suggest at this point CenterPlan, but I'm not a construction guy. It just seems like they've gone this far. And with the appropriate agreement for penalties or no penalties, get the job done. You've been over there. I don't know if you've been inside. It's awful.
Many times. I know. I thought it was. Last time I was in there was before they put the chain around it. It was like a week before they pulled the plug on the project, and I thought it was close then.
You know, the bottom line is that safety considerations are very important, and a lot of what's left is things like the sprinkler system and railings and safety, and I don't mean to belittle those things, but if you had to go in there right now and play baseball, you could, and the construction build-out is going to be finished. I cannot imagine a scenario at this point where it falls flat, but of course, if you had asked me a year ago, could I imagine a scenario where there wouldn't be one single game played in the summer of 2016, I would have said, no, I can't imagine that either.
I mean, it really would be the ultimate disaster if somehow that ballpark is not finished and Hartford loses its franchise.
If you already have two black eyes, can you get a third?
Now, getting back to Hartford's financial situation, you said Hartford is not Detroit. Is Hartford a Waterbury?
Yes. Waterbury, in 02? Is that right?
That's right.
The state board, yes. Hartford is very similar to that. And you know, there are obviously in each city, there are always some differences. Waterbury didn't have, had some very significant school costs, as I recall, just going from memory. Hartford has probably closer to average on the school costs, but has some debt issues, especially pensions, and has much higher union costs. I'm sorry, union costs were similar in both. So some similarities and some differences. In terms of the severity of the problem, Hartford might be a little worse, but it's closer to Waterbury 02 than Detroit 2013.
What does this do from Hartford's perspective for attracting business? Can Hartford attract a business or businesses, even if they're small startups, when it's faced with this kind of a situation?
Well, I went to Detroit. And I'm writing a story about that. And many people that I spoke with in Detroit tell me that when the city got to filing the bankruptcy, that was viewed as a positive thing by the business community because it was viewed as the city facing its problems and coming up with what we hope, they hope, is a long-term solution. There's some debate about whether the solution is long-term or not, But the point is that it forces the city to reckon with its problem rather than the famous kicking the can down the road, which cities and states do tend to do for political expediency. So it can work to your benefit if the bankruptcy is viewed as equitable and effective.
What are we looking for in the way of a time frame to get this thing resolved so we know what the future of Hartford is going to be, or at least the steps are in place to determine a better future?
I don't think anybody knows, and the mayor is not talking about bankruptcy other than to say he wants to avoid bankruptcy, which would be nice. The legislature almost definitely has to get involved legally. Legally, the governor's office has to approve, but the state legislature does not. But it's hard to imagine a bankruptcy being viable with a bankruptcy judge accepting the terms without it going through the legislature and them having a chance to weigh in, as they did in Waterbury in 02 and, for that matter, in Bridgeport in 1991. So the legislature has to get involved, and we're seeing legislation form. I think my colleague Jenna Carlesso has written about some of that. We're going to see some plans in the legislature in this coming session in 2017, and if they move forward, that may avert a potential bankruptcy, and if they don't move forward, that may make a potential bankruptcy more likely.
I guess my point is, we can't be sitting here a year from now having the same conversation. Would that be right?
The mayor believes, not in respect of bankruptcy, but in respect to the city's finances broadly, that there is a short time frame of opportunity to do something and that it can't drag out. Now, you've got negotiations with the city's police, fire, and municipal unions ongoing now. The mayor needs $15.5 million in this current fiscal year. Even if he gets it, if nothing else changes, there's a shortfall of an additional $30 million for the fiscal year that starts next July 1st. So all of that speaks to an urgency to get things done sooner rather than later. And so I would tend to agree with him. The one wild card is I've gotten a lot of comments over the last couple of days from people who say that the mill rate, famously at 74 mills, way higher than any other city, is dampened by the fact that houses, 1-4 family houses, are taxed at a lower rate than houses elsewhere at 70% of value. In Hartford, I believe it's 35 or 30 or 40. The number is moving upward, but it's still not very high. So the point is the tax rate is not the same in Hartford as it is in West Hartford or other towns. That's getting a little bit into the weeds, but it may be a solution as to where a little bit of money can come.
Yeah. Before we let you go, I want to get your take, because you follow this stuff so closely, on this liquor battle that's taking place with Total Wine and BevMax against the rest of the liquor industry in the state.
How can the state, against the governor, a commissioner of consumer protection, and a populace that's always looking for lower cost consumer goods in every industry, how can the state of Connecticut continue to hold forth these liquor laws that have artificially high prices? Everybody loves the local package stores. The owners do a great service in society because they're sort of the fabric of every community. They create jobs. But in terms of consumer pricing, it goes against the general direction that the economy has been in so many industries. I just don't see those laws holding up any much longer.
Okay, so Total Wine and BevMax obviously hope to win this in court, but in the meantime, what they're doing is violating the law. So that said, what should the state be doing?
Well, they ought to be punished, and they ought to be shut down while they're violating the law. You can't have that. This idea that somebody from one of those companies, I believe it was BevMax, that said, I could be wrong, it could be Total Wine, that said that an unjust law, violating an unjust law is okay, that works in respect to things like safety. That doesn't work in respect to regulation. If you have an unjust law that puts somebody's life at risk, you violate that law. If you have an unjust law in respect to consumer product regulation, that's ridiculous. That statement is ridiculous. And those companies have to be punished and fined and even shut down. You can't just allow them to sell. I mean, they may be right, and I think a lot of people think they're right. Ultimately, they're going to win. But I don't know. What do you think? I'll turn the interview around. What do you think should happen?
Well, as much as I think I'm on the same page with you as far as this is concerned, I want to see prices as low as possible. But by the same token, you do have laws, and you just can't, as a company, arbitrarily say, well, I'm not going to observe that law because I don't agree with it. So the state has to go after them.
Yeah, there's a fine line in American culture between the maverick and the nuisance. You know, everybody likes a good maverick. We all love our John Ford Westerns and, you know, the spirit of independence and do what you want, that's the right thing. But there was always a more moral component to it than just the profit motive. And I don't see that here in this case.
But what makes it such a fascinating story, Dan, is you've got, for example, the liquor industry, which forever has dominated Connecticut with its strong lobby, and now you've got Total Wine and BevMax coming along. I don't know about BevMax, but didn't Total Wine contribute heavily to either the Malloy campaign or the Democratic Party? So you have all those dynamics in play.
Yeah, they might have. I mean, listen, when I said it's inevitable, what I mean is that, as we've seen with the big box stores in books, in hardware, in so many other industries, low prices do win out in food. You know, the small retailers aren't going to beat back a movement for lower prices. But that said, I don't think it's necessarily a good thing in society. The number of social ills that have come around because of cheap consumer prices is legion, and it has to do with job losses to Asia, job losses to Mexico, what Donald Trump is talking about. Now, I may not agree with him politically in many places, but he's tapping into a real belief, a real feeling that people have, and that a lot of it is at the foot of cheap consumer goods. It's not so much bad politics as it is cheap consumer goods. What we pay for in exchange for being able to go buy a set of fitted king size 400 thread sheets for $30 is a lot.
It sure is. And on that note, Dan, we thank you very much. Always a pleasure having you on the program. Very informative.
Pleasure, Dan. Have a great afternoon.
You too. We'll talk soon. Take care. Dan Haar writes on business, the economy, politics, and the people of Connecticut for the Hartford Current.